Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your kind invitation to talk to you this morning. I've heard of Tommy Tucker singing for his supper, but talking for your breakfast, that's a new one on me. So what I'd like to talk to you about this morning is the trials and tribulations of being a battlefield guide, which I've spent the last 20 years as a battlefield guide to, as Roger just said, most of the Mediterranean activities from World War I and World War II. I suppose the question is, why do you have a battlefield guide? Well, first of all, it's the person, and anything goes wrong, you're in charge. There's no doubt about that, that it's your fault. So the people that you take, usually a busload, you've got to look after them. You've got to make sure that they enjoy their trip. Some of them grizzle like mad for the whole time. Some are so grateful for you being there that they're wonderful to work with. How did I become a guide? Well, as Roger said, I was at the War Memorial for 22 years, and at one stage in the late 90s, I decided that Joan and I'd go for a trip around the world, and of course we went via all the battlefields that I've been reading about. By the age of 12 or 13, I'd read two volumes of the official history of the Second World War, because that's where my father had bought them, because he'd served there, particularly Greece, Crete and Syria, and two Benghazi. And so naturally I took a great interest in where we went. And when I came back to work at the War Memorial, the next year the War Memorial decided it would extend its activities by having battlefield guides to Gallipoli and to France. And they asked me, would I become a guide for Gallipoli? I have done one to France, but it's a bit sort of a bit of imagination when you go to France. There's this huge big paddock and it's full of canola or something or other, and you're trying to explain that that was full of trenches and this is where the Red Baron crashed or something along, and the people just look at all they can see, the field of canola. Whereas if you go to Gallipoli, you can stand in a trench, you can stand on the edge of the water, and you can say, this is what happened here, here and here. There's two ways in which I approach battlefield guiding. Well, there's two ways that you can approach it. One, you get the guide that knows every man, woman and child that ever went into the place, and it's great to tell the people what happened, etc., 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 and Fred Nurk did this, and Colonel so-and-so did that. But perhaps from my army experience, I prefer to explain why the battle was there and what are the conditions and what were the tactics that were being employed. Because people can go back and read the books themselves and they can get all the personal information they want out of it. But what they need is someone there to explain what was going on, what were the tactics, etc. Now, the simple thing is, you try to explain to people about machine gun fire. And everyone has the idea that machine gun just go rat-tat-tat-tat and there's this one stream of bullets going out, end of story. But what of course happens with a machine gun, not every bullet goes in the same direction and the same length. So you get what's called a cone of fire. So I've worked out, this is a bit hard to explain to people, till I got the idea of a hose. You get a hold of a hose and you squirt it out, and they can see that it goes in a stream, and then when it lands on the ground, it doesn't just land on a stream like that, it has a zone like that. And then if you tell people that if you're facing it, the killing zone is, of course, smaller than if you're on a flank. So it's called enfilade fire. And this is particularly important when you're trying to explain to people the trench lines and the battles that were at Gallipoli, because it was the machine gun fire that was catching people in enfilade that does all the damage. So they're the reasons that I became a guide, and I'm very pleased that I was able to help a lot of people to understand the campaigns. Now, who goes on a battlefield tour? Well, 20 years ago, the first time I did a guide to Gallipoli, out of 32 people on the bus, and four of them were children, 27 had a relative who was in World War I and I mean a direct relative like a father or an uncle, and 23 had their father had served at Gallipoli. And it was one of those trips where every so often that chap would pull out of a woman would pull out of a handbag or out of his backpack a diary and read extracts from their father or their uncle who served in that particular spot. And it was my great pleasure to take them to that particular spot so they could stand where their relative had been and why he wrote that particular words, etc. It changed over the years. We then got that sort of group. Once they'd been, of course, they didn't want to go back. They won people when I started doing two tours a year. They'd do Anzac Day, and then I used to do Gallipoli in depth, which was about October. It had to be after the AFL Grand Final. except one year that we deferred it for after the AFL Grand Final. Bugger me dead, they had a draw, didn't they? So they got caught. But then you got the more distant relatives, and you get the avid history reader. They're rather hard to cater for sometimes, but particularly you can keep one step in front if you remember the book that they read, if you read it as well. You get the people who just have a sort of an avid interest, sort of want to know, this is Gallipoli, this is Crete, this is North Africa. And they're the best people, I find, in that they're attentive all the time. They're not trying to tell you what they know, but they listen to what you're trying to tell them. So they're the best. And then you get the tourists, and they couldn't care less where they are as long as they're overseas and they're down in the bar straight away at 5 o'clock and all these sorts of things. And that's some of the things that you have to cater for. When I was with the War Memorial for a couple of trips, we had two buses, two guides, and my guiding, I'd have them on the bus by 8 o'clock. And away we go. Then it was back by 12 o'clock and on the bus again at 1:30 and back again at 4. And that way I gave people a chance when they got back at 4 o'clock they could do any of their admin or they could go to the bar and have a drink or have a yarn. My oppo, he was a late starter. It was always 9:30 before he got him on the bus. And then he'd get them back just in time for lunch at about 12:30. And then they'd be coming in the dark about 8 o'clock. And they'd be whinging and going on because, you know, the barbecue was half eaten and all that sort of stuff. So you've got to take into account the different groups of people that you're taking around. now, the things that can happen to the guide. I had a couple of rather interesting things. One of my sins, my son was a teacher in Arnhem Land, and I used to drive up to Arnhem Land and do a lot of hunting for the Aboriginal communities by supplying them with buffalo meat, etc. And one of them, I'd wearing a pair of boots, and I'd worn them ungallipoli at least twice. And this time, when we were out in Arnhem Land, the day before I was to fly out to pick up a group in Istanbul, somehow or other, it rubbed all the skin off the back of my heel. And it was agony. And I got back into Darwin and went to the chemist and got these bandages and everything to put on me. Now, when you get down to the Gallipoli, I used to have all these long walks, particularly one from Rhododendron Ridge that was from Chunuk Bear all the way down to the beach. Always took people downhill. It's a lot easier than taking them uphill. That's where the New Zealanders had attacked in the August offensive. So here I could hardly bloody walk. And I couldn't wear these boots, so luckily I'd had a pair of sneakers. So when we got down to the beach, down to Gallipoli, luckily it rained. So I kept putting off the big walks, etc. I said, oh no, the track's too muddy, etc., etc. So I got through about 7 or 8 days before the back of my heels would heal up so I could put on a pair of boots. Then we did the walking. So you can get caught out. Another time I was driving up to Northern Territory before a trip. And I don't know why, I was between, I think it was Mount Isa and Three Ways. You go across the plain there. And I put my hand up to my face for whatever reason. I couldn't see. So I put my hand up the other side. That's all right, I can see. Put it up this side. Couldn't see a bloody thing. I thought, hello. Have I had a stroke? I don't know. So when we got to Three Ways, I rang my son. He was in Darwin. And said, listen, I'll be there on Sunday morning. Can you find me a doctor? They might have to have a look. And he said, oh, he said, it's Sunday. He said, we'll take you to the hospital. I said, all right. So I went into the hospital. Interesting, as I was walking in the door, I met one of the mates from the army who served in Vietnam together. He was coming out. And so we had a bit of a yarn. And then they said, oh, yeah, went in and registered. Said, what's the matter? And I said, well, I can't see out of one eye. And they said, maybe you... I said, I think I might have had a minor stroke or something, you know. And they said, oh, okay. Well, we're very lucky. They said that the resident doctor on service this afternoon is an eye specialist. So I thought, oh, great. So anyway, I got... To cut a long story short, I got checked out. Fuck if you did. I had cataracts. And the cataract had just gone that far... That over that eye, at that stage, I couldn't see out of it. Anyway, we did the trip, no problem. And he gave me a note and said, go and get your cataracts done and an operation in Canberra when you get back. So I did that. And at the end of the trip, we usually have a farewell dinner. And anyway, we're having this farewell dinner in a hotel in Istanbul. So I got up to give him a little spiel, etc., etc. And I ended up and I said, and by the way, I said, you've had the first one-eyed trip around Gallipoli you've ever had. you can have luggage problems. I always made a point in the backpack, change your undies, shirt, handkerchief, socks, etc. in your backpack. Because you never know that one that went into the hole where it was going to end up. And that happened to me once. I got to Istanbul, no luggage, nothing. Anyway, so that's a dealer check. Interesting, the Singapore Airlines gave me $125 because the luggage hadn't turned up. And it turned off, they'd offloaded it in Dubai for whatever reason, I don't know. It took me about 3 days to get it back to Istanbul. So you can get caught, so you've got to be prepared for all those sorts of activities. Now, when I was at the War Memorial, we travelled on government passports. And the War Memorial would go and get a visa in it for you to go to Turkey at the embassy in Canberra. So I did a trip for Anzac Day, and then it must have been the year 2000, I had the Olympics at Sydney, the exact dates that we had a conference at Gallipoli with a mixture of people from the War Memorial and the Imperial War Museum in London. And anyway, they looked at my passport, which I didn't keep, the admin always kept it, and it had a stamp in it that said, valid for 1 year in English, right? But then in Turkish, it said, one trip. They gave it to me saying, you're right, it's valid for 1 year. So, oh, so I get in, walk in and out to the passport control at Istanbul Airport, and after you've ushered all your people through and or taken them up where they, $20 you had to pay, and they just stamped it and away you went. So they looked at mine and said, you haven't got a valid visa. I said, yes, it is. Look, it's got valid for 12 months. And that's when he read it in the Turkish. He said, yes, for one trip. So this is my second trip that year. So he said, oh, don't worry, come with us. So all the rest of the group are outside. Lucky they're all War Memorial staff. They're out in the foyer of the airport. They're waiting for me. And I'm ushered into a little office. And anyway, talking away to people. Oh, they very kindly got me a cup of coffee and whatnot. And I said, look, can I go and buy a passport, a visa at the visa office? Just give over my $20 and get it stamped. Oh, no, because it's a government passport. We can't have that happening because that's only for people with their personal passport. I was whipping the cat out and bought my own, but never mind. So I'm sitting there, and a fellow said, oh, he said, we should turn the TV on. We watch the TV. So I turned the TV on, and it's Midnight Express. I don't know whether everyone remembers that was a film about the chap that was put in a jail in Turkey and eventually has to escape, etc. So anyway, I'm sitting there looking at that saying, oh, lovely, lovely, you know. Anyway, been there about 20 minutes and all of a sudden an officer runs in, jibbers away in Turkish for about 10 seconds, and the guy that I'm sitting opposite at his office desk reaches into the drawer, pulls out a rubber stamp, puts the passport, stamps it like that, gives it back to me. Ow! I thought, why couldn't he have done that 20 minutes ago? They had nothing to do that day, did they? So they thought, you know, they talked to me. What had happened, they'd caught a Chinese family coming through with false passports. Much bigger game than silly old Bill without a visa. So that's some of the things that can happen to you. And the things that can happen to the travellers. Well, first of all, it was my recommendation that if you're over 60, 65, for God's sake, travel business class. It might cost you about $5,000-$6,000 extra, but you survive the trip a lot better. And what we did find was a lot of women, particularly when they're in the cattle class, and they're in a row of, you know, 8, 10 or whatever it is, they don't want to drink because they might have to get up and go to the toilet. And some of these women have been used to doing, you know, anything up to 8-10 cups of tea a day, right? So all of a sudden, they're 27 hours on a trip to Turkey, and they won't drink. So they end up, it leads to dehydration. So they get into Turkey, they get into the hotel, and they're completely dehydrated out, and they collapse. And then you got the problem of trying to get them into hospital, because they've got to be saline drip, etc., etc. So and the hospitals in Turkey are good, very good, in fact, in some cases. I had one chap who'd been a sergeant in the 2nd 7th Battalion and been in the Middle East campaign to Benghazi, back again to Greece, onto Crete, got away from Crete. And anyway, he had certain medical problems which he mentioned, and he sort of got very ill, so we took him into Şanakkale. We took him into Şanakkale to a clinic, I guess what I could say it was. And anyway, oh, he got wonderful service. They gave him all ultrasound tests and all sorts of things, and he came out with a list of medication that he had to have, right? So off to find a chemist, and we found the chemist, and I was amazed that some of the material I was looking in while they were making up his prescription, some of the things that you pay for about $30 or $40 in Australia were equivalent to $2 in this chemist shop in Istanbul, Şanakkale, sorry. Probably it was generic stuff that came from India and places like that, which wasn't so good, or was good for him anyway. So after that trip, he then went on to France to do another 2 weeks, 3 weeks in France. And again, he got sick. So they whisked him into a Paris, into a medical clinic there. And they said, oh, look, it's no problem. Look, he's got all this medicine. They took one look at it and threw it all in the bin. No, that was no good. He had to have another lot. So he survived the whole trip. I came home, etc., but I often wondered what, if he'd brought all the stuff back to Australia, what would have happened back here? Would he have been able to keep any of it? My tour operator, the travel agent I worked for, he was in Turkey, and middle of the night he gets massive pain in his chest and his stomach. Anyway, they rushed him off to the Şanakkale hospital from down at the peninsula, and they diagnosed that he had a twisted bowel. So they said, oh, don't worry, we'll do a little keyhole surgery and we'll fix this, you know. what did they do? They perforated his bowel, and he ended up in hospital in, where they take him to? Back to Istanbul, to the American University Hospital. He was there for 2 months, and he eventually, they reckon he was well enough to travel back to Australia. He got back to Australia, to Melbourne, and it was another 4 weeks in hospital in Melbourne trying to recover. And what I was leading to is always take out travel insurance, because he said it would have been up around about $700,000 or $800,000 that it would have cost him if he hadn't had travel insurance. So the message is always have your travel insurance. And you can have the enthusiast who decides that he won't get any laundry done. He'll wash his clothes himself, you know, at the hotel. So he does that, and then finds out he's just put his passport through the washing machine. That leads to a bit of problem. You've got to go and find in Istanbul the consulate general, and they issue you with a page that says that this is a passport, etc., etc. You've got to have your mangled remains plus the sheet of paper. So that's one of the things. And another time, took this lady to a chemist, no, to a medical, a doc, hospital actually, in Shanakali, which is about 50k from Gallipoli, the battlefield. And at that stage, I was working with the travel agent. He had two groups. Well, actually, he's running then about 10 groups, because there was all sorts of DVA and all the other hangers-on, etc. And he had people in two different hotels, and they were about 20-30k apart. So he said, all right, you can have a car. So here I am with this car, a hire car, and driving on the wrong side of the road, as I said. And every time I came to an intersection, I used to say, passenger in the gutter, passenger in the gutter. So that way I didn't end up going in the wrong direction, on the wrong side of the road. Anyway, I took this lady to the hospital, and yes, mumble, mumble. And it happened to be a weekend. That's right, it was a Saturday. And they said, oh, here's a list of chemists that she has to go and get the medication at. I said, oh, righto, okay. And I get in the car, she gets in the car, then I look at the list, and there's seven chemists on it. And I had the address of each one. So away I go. It was Saturday. They were all closed except one, and that was the last one I got to. And so they have a roster for the chemists, so that only one's open of a weekend. So I happened to have the list of seven, but they hadn't put which one was working that weekend. So that took most of the afternoon to do that. So then you get what I call the VIPs, because I not only just took ordinary busloads of people. The travel agent had lined me up with just to take a VIP or a group. One of them I had was the ABC, which I had worked with previously, as Roger mentioned. And they had the Compass program. And the Compass program that they were running was for the TV was in Sydney. They chose a university student and a celebrity or a VIP in the legal system who they were going to take to Gallipoli to a grave of a relative. Now, the young girl that they got from the university student, no problem whatsoever, she was okay. Anyway, because they flew over as a different group and I had to meet them after I'd taken an ordinary group through. And we're standing on the road that runs between the trenches at Gallipoli, between Lone Pine and up, going up to Chunuk Bear. And the car pulls up and out gets all the camera crew, etc. I said, oh, yeah. And I said, oh, the celebrities are arriving very soon. I said, oh, yeah, right. I said, the information I have, they want to go to 4th Battalion Parade Ground Cemetery. They said, that's right. I said, oh, that's good. Now, 4th Battalion Parade Ground Cemetery was 300 metres down a very steep cliff, down, and a good path all the way. It had been, you know, really done, but it's full of steps, all riveted steps all the way down. Right? And they said, the girl was no problem, the way she went. They said, the next gentleman that's coming along, I used to say, I've never put his name out, but I can, because Annie died last month, and that was Sir Lawrence Street, the Chief Justice of New South Wales. And he'd come to see his uncle's grave at this particular... Anyway, pulls up in the car, he gets out, his wife gets out, and their teenage daughter, and I see he's got two walking sticks. And a fellow said, he's just had a back operation, he can't walk far. And I said, oh my God, there's two bloody thing down to the cemetery. And you got to think laterally sometimes. And I knew up about 100 yards away was the Lone Pine, and there was the, what they call the Federation Guard, which is a guard of servicemen that spend 12 months doing all the ceremonial duties for the government. And they were practicing at Lone Pine. So I thought, ooh, I wonder if I might get them to sort of help this chap along, you know. So I rushed up there, and there's a warrant officer in charge of them. There was about 20 to 30 of the fellas there. And I rushed up to him and I said who I was, what a problem I had, and do you think I could borrow some of his soldiers to help? And he looks at me, he leans over and he says, were you in 7RAR, the battalion, at Holsworthy? I said, oh yeah, I was an NCO there. Why? He said, I was one of the privates you trained for infantry activities. I said, oh, what is it? I couldn't remember, I'd never know. He said, I remember you. I said, I remember you. Anyway, he said, righto, he said, what can we do? I said, well, I'd like a few soldiers that could help this Sir Lawrence Street down, and particularly bring him back up. And he said, no worries. He said, righto, Bill. They whistled over about 30 chaps, and they literally carried him almost down the steps. And we thought, I wonder what he's going to do when he gets to his uncle's grave. He didn't have a wreath or a posy of flowers or something like that. Anyway, so I take him up, show him the grave, right, he stands in front of it, he reaches into his pocket and pulled out a 50-cent piece and poked it into the dirt. That was his contribution, a 50-cent piece. Anyway, so he had to take, the soldiers had to go back up, because I used to then take the group on from there down Shrapnel Valley and come out at the beach. So the soldier just grabbed him under the arms like that, straight up the hill they went with him, so he was very lucky. That otherwise he'd never have got down and back to his uncle's grave. So then you have you get problems sometimes with the ABC. We have a lady that's on radio these days, particularly on Saturday mornings with Saturday Extra, and I was booked to take her at 8:30 from the hotel down to the beach and explain the actions, etc. Anyway, I get there with a car and a driver at 8:30, no sign of her. So I wait about 10 minutes, no sign of her again. So I walk into the hotel. No, it's not in the foyer. I thought she might have been waiting for me in there. So eventually I find the dining room, and here she is sitting back holding forth with a couple of people, talking away like steam, you know. But this stage it's about 9 o'clock, I suppose. 8:30 was the thing. And the program, I had other people to take at 11. So anyway, I went up to her, Geraldine Duge. And I went up to her and I said, excuse me, Geraldine. I said, you had a car booked for 8:30 to take you on. Oh, yes, well, don't worry, I'll be there. I said, well, if you're not out there in 10 minutes, it won't be there, right? Well, the look she gave me, I don't think anyone had ever talked to her like that before. But, you know, yes, she is, yeah. But anyway, so eventually she fell into line, and but some of the other ABC chaps are really good. They were wonderful to work with. Andrew Denton. You will probably know Andrew Denton with his Nuff Rope or whatever it was called, the program. Well, he wanted to do a program on Gallipoli. So I got booked to take him there with his camera crew, his wife, and a little boy who was about 10 or 12. And they'd been to Europe, and his wife kept telling me that the lad had been to 27 art museums. And I thought, I bet he bloody enjoyed every one of them, didn't he? Anyway, so Andrew's there, and we do filming here, there, and everywhere. And he comes up, he said, oh, look, he said, I'd like to do a film from a boat at dawn looking towards the shore at Gallipoli. Can you organise it? I said, oh, yeah, I'll try. Right. Anyway, he said, I'll pay, no problem. All right. Anyway. So I went and saw the chaps at the Coolmore Hotel where we were staying. And they said, yeah, no worries, come with me. So we went down, got this fishing boat, quite large fishing boat, and with a cabin and everything on it, and they hired it, etc. He said, we'll put it on his bill. I said, beauty, I don't have to get involved. And so I thought, well, we're going out, it's going to be cold in the morning, so I rustled around at the hotel and got thermoses of coffee and biscuits and some fruitcake, I think I even managed to get, you know. So we get out there in the boat, and he's filming away and talking to camera and doing his piece, etc. And I said, well, anyone like a cup of coffee? Oh, yes, there's a camera crew. So what about you, Andy? I only drink tea. Yeah. Ah, do you? Well, I said, you either drink coffee at the moment because we're about a mile offshore, or you don't get anything to drink, you know? So, right, fair enough. So he didn't have a cup of tea. He didn't have a cup of coffee either. And we get back, go back, have the breakfast, and then he wants to go off somewhere else. That's right, he wanted to go to Shrapnel Valley Cemetery. So I was rushed around, and I said to the chaps in the kitchen, I said, look, I want thermos, the hot water, boiling water, teapot, and tea. Oh, all right. Yeah. So I got it all together, put it in a bag. Away I get to the cemetery, and he's off there filming, etc. So I thought, I'll make up the tea. You know, so get out the teapot, open this bag of tea they'd given me, pour it into the teapot, pour in the hot water, and it just all floated to the top. It must have been 90% dust. It was absolutely terrible, see? Anyway, and I've already said, look, I'm making a cup of tea for you. And they said, righto, we'll be right over, you know. So I said, oh, my God, I went to pour it out, and all the tea leaves just floated to the top in the cup. So luckily, I had with me my Ruger's cap with a strainer in it. So I strained his cup of tea through the hat. And he was, Janita Jacoby was his PA executive officer, or whatever they wanted to call him. She was killing herself laughing when she saw it. She said, I will keep that for years and then give it to him one day, she said. Yeah. So Andrew was caught with his cup of tea, and he was none the wiser. And another person I took was Bryce Courtney, which you all know is the author, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago. And he was doing this trilogy, and the one on Gallipoli, or the World War One, was Solomon's Song, was the name of the book. So anyway, I took Bryce there, and he was great to work with, absolutely marvellous. And when the book came out, and he sent me a copy, and in the acknowledgements, this is what he wrote. I have a special debt of gratitude to Bill Fogarty, Senior Curator of Photograph, Sound and Film at the Australian War Memorial. Bill was with me at Gallipoli, and together we covered the battlegrounds where, in a true sense, Australia forged many of these unique elements which make us who we are as a nation today. For the many bottles of cheap and utterly atrocious local red wine shared as we pondered over maps and explanations. I thought I bought him good stuff. For reading and correcting the military details in this book, and for the willingness to help at high speed, we shall ever be grateful to you, Bill. And I would be very surprised if Bill Fogarty, of the Australian War Memorial, who supplied material and painstakingly detail of my narrative, have got any of the hard facts wrong. If so, it's me that's at fault. So it was very nice of him to write that, but yeah, I didn't like this about the bottles of cheap red wine. Though it's interesting, the changes in Turkey. 20 years ago, a bottle of Yakit red wine cost about Australian $5. It was drinkable. It was probably, you know, equivalent to a $10 or $15 bottle in Australia. Change of the government. Beer you can drink. Wine and spirits you can't. Muslims. Country. The last time I was there was $80 Australian for the same bottle of Yakit. That's the tax that they put on it to discourage people drinking it. Bryce was very helpful and generous. After the trip back in Australia the next year, he rang me up and he said, look, I've got all these frequent flyer points that could you find someone who was deserving a trip to Gallipoli that I can get them for him so he doesn't have to pay. So at that stage we knew they were going to open the Australian Memorial at North Beach, because prior to that they were holding the dawn services in the cemeteries, and the cemeteries were small, and of course the patronage had grown and grown and grown, so they built a special memorial. And it was, being Anzac, I knew the New Zealanders would be involved, and the New Zealanders always have a Maori content in their services. So I thought, well, we're not going to be done out of this. Why can't we have an Aboriginal activity in our opening service? So I went to Air Vice Marshal Beck. He was the head of Australian War Service. Office of Australian War Service, War Cemeteries. And I said, you're going to have a big do on this, aren't you? Oh, yes, yes, we're going to have this, and there's Prime Minister's going to be there, and the Leader of the Opposition, Prince Charles, the whole box and dice will be there. I said, well, the New Zealanders are going to have a Maori activity, you know, some poor soldier in a grass skirt and a spear or something or other. And he said, yeah, yeah, they've already said that. I said, well, why can't we have a smoking ceremony? Bit of Australiana for an Aborigine. Oh, he said, I'm not sure about smoking ceremony. I said, all right. How about a didgeridoo player? Yeah, yeah, he said, we can put that in the service. Yeah, we'd have a didgeridoo player. So one of the soldiers I'd had at Duntroon, an Aborigine, and when he left, he was a sapper in the engineers. Great football player. Whacked people around the ankles and they fell flat on their face every time. He left the army and he became a parson down the south coast of Ulla Dulla and in that area there. I knew his son was a very professional didgeridoo player. In fact, he played for the Queen at Government House when she'd been out here. So I rang Tommy up and I said, listen, would your son like a trip to Gallipoli? And he said, oh, sure he would, you know. So I said, well, tell him to contact me. So he contacted me, so we had a discussion. Yes, he'd be prepared to go. I said, now you'll have to take your didgeridoo, etc., etc. And he said, yeah, righto. And so that was, I rang back to Bryce and he said, yeah, no worries. He said, I'll pay for his lot. You know, just go and see John Waller at the Baronia Travel and I'll fix it all for him. So away we went. And we spend about 4 days in Istanbul before you go down to the peninsula. And he used to go out to all the Irish pubs around the town, play didgeridoo and made a fortune. Anyway, we get to the service. We're going to have it at the service and it's a dawn service. And I was still interested in having this smoking ceremony. And I was walking around the caravan park where near the hotel, and there's a chap, and he's got this little, what they call the Portuguese barbecue. It was a cast iron little, like a stove. And he's cooking his breakfast on it. And I said, where'd you get that? He said, oh, he said, I travel with it. He said, it just unhooks, etc., and folds up flat. But he said, you can throw a few sticks in it, and away you go. I said, listen, I said, I'll do you a deal. I said, do you want to go to the dawn service? Oh, yeah, he said, but I've got to walk. It's going to take hours. I said, I'll get you a lift if I can borrow your stove. Okay? So he said, oh, yeah, righto. So comes the day, I'd taken over a bag of Australian gum leaves because I was determined over this bloody smoking syrup. So we get there and I had another ex-warrant officer from Vietnam. He was an engineer too. Anyway, West Australian too. Anyway, I said, right, now I said, go down behind the back of the ceremony area I said, and light this up and get it so you can just lift it up by the handles each side of little hooks. And then we can bring it out and we'll put it in front of the hole of the activity and then we'll throw on the gum leaves, right? I said, we won't tell Air Vice Marshal Beck anything about it. All he'll think he's getting is the didgeridoo. So, righto. So he goes round the back, he sets fire to this thing and gets it burning away like mad. So, and Beck comes along. And he said, what are you doing? He said, I'm cooking me breakfast. all right, well, don't be long. Oh, yeah, yeah. Anyway, then he said, I looked down and he said, fucking me. Right underneath where he'd lit the fire, under the little stand, with all the cables from the TV were going back to the OB van that was sending back to Australia and all sorts of things. So he set this fire on top of it all. So anyway, he lifts it away and gets it. And I gave him the whistle. Slocky's playing his didgeridoo piece. And he'd gone off and put all his white paint on and little undies, etc. Red undies. And he wasn't wearing them on his head. And so we bring out this fireplace, put it down, put in all the gum leaves. And all this smoke came up. And oh, the crowd, the smell of the gum leaves. And oh, they went mad. Ray. And they said, Beck was going around, where's that bloody Fogarty? Where's that bloody Fogarty? Anyway, it went off quite well because Tommy's son with his didgeridoo playing. And actually, he rushed down into the water after it finished to wash off all his white paint, etc. And it was absolutely freezing at the time. He came back and, what's his name? He's just taken over. Kim Beazley, the governor of Western Australia. He took off his overcoat and put it around the fella. So it was quite interesting in that way. So, you know, Bryce was so impressed when I phoned him back and said what had happened, etc., etc. He said, oh, he said, would he like to go on to France? And I said, oh, I'll have to go and ask him, you know. And, of course, he said, righto. He said, I'll tell John Waller I'll pay for him. So he took him to France for another 2 weeks and he played the didgeridoo over there as well. So Bryce was very good in that respect and looking after people. Now, you also have difficulties. One of the funny things in Turkey was I always carried a first aid kit. And anyway, we're in Şanakkale and we're on the waterfront waiting for the ferry to come in so you can go across to Etchebat to again get the bus and go down to Gallipoli. And I had a woman there and all of a sudden I looked down and she's got blood pouring down her leg. I said, what the hell has happened? Oh, she said, I don't know. Anyway, it turned out she'd walked past a plastic garbage bin, hard plastic, that had been broken. And a point was sticking out the side. And as she walked past it, she cut the side of her leg. And, of course, she was on, is it Wolfram? For blood clotting or something, is it? Yeah. Because, anyway, I said, oh, hang on, righto. So out with the first aid kit and I sat her down at the waterfront there and I'm doing all my first aid treatment, etc., and putting the bandage on and all that sort of stuff. I said, there you are, that sort of be okay. I looked around and behind me there must have been 50 people that have all gathered there to watch this happening there. So I'm glad I wasn't going to operate and take it off. then you can have, in Egypt, I had some terrible visa problems in Egypt. We'd done a trip through Gallipoli, and then we did a trip up the Nile, came back, we're going to fly from Cairo to Libya. And I'd been to the Libyan embassy in Canberra and about getting organising visas, and they said, look, no problem. He said, give me the list of names and all the passport numbers. And they gave me one page and had all the names, all their passport numbers and all the official stamps and signs and all over it. And he said, that's all you need, right? So we get to the airport at Cairo. We're ready to leave, catch the plane. Two things had happened. One, Egyptian Airlines had had a blue with the Libyan Airlines and didn't want any cooperation whatsoever. And the immigration people at Cairo said, oh no, you can't leave. You haven't got a passport for them, a visa in their passport. to enter Libya. We can't let you go. I said, we don't need it. I've got it here on a piece of paper. Oh, that's not good enough, you know. So it took 2 hours of negotiations and whatnot, and it went up a level. And as it turned out, I found out later, it was just being narky because it had the blue with the Libyan Airlines. So eventually they said, yes, okay, right. We had 10 minutes to get on the plane. I mean, we were just down to the wire, and I'm sure the buggers did that just on purpose. Anyway, we get to Libya, and I thought, ooh, I wonder how, I better get this sorted out. So I got everyone lined up, oh, I think it was 27 people, in the same order that's on the piece of paper. Well, that's great, I said, now, and you get to the immigration control, and there's an office over there that said, groups or group tourists or something or other, so I thought, well, that's where I'll go. Anyway, I heard a bit of a commotion behind me, and one of our chaps, them trying to be the very helpful Australian, there's this woman going along, all up under the slits of the eye, right? She's got one baby up here, she's got one in a pram, and another little girl hanging onto the skirt here, and a little boy hanging onto the skirt here, and she's got this great big bloody suitcase, see? And there's the husband walking 7 paces in front, nothing, he's just walking along, you know. Anyway, one of our chaps said, oh, I'll do the right thing, so I'll carry that for you, missus, you know, sort of thing. Well, everyone just stopped, and I thought, uh-oh. So I walked up and I said, just give it back very quietly and then walk away. He said, why? I said, you don't interfere. I said, if his family wants to run the place that way, you let them run the place that way, right? Oh, he said, okay, so that was all right. So I thought, well, that's got off to a good start. Let's see how we go at the immigration office. So I get over there, present the thing. I said, they're all lined up here. Want to check them off? Oh, he said, oh, hang on. Reaches behind, two-ring binder comes out, opens it up. Yep, there you go. All right, way you go. He had a copy, no worries, as long as there was the same number, he didn't care who they were. And again in Libya, the last time I went there was in the end of November 2010, and the place was very humming, and we were, you know, just, it didn't seem feel good to be there. What we used to do, we go from Tripoli, we go out to a Roman city, a relic of a Roman city called Leptis Magna, and we do a day trip there and come back to, and then fly out to Benghazi. So we go out to the Leptis Magna, and on the way back, we're travelling along, and in Libya on the main highway, about every 20, 30 miles, there was a police station, right? And they'd stop the bus, check everybody, then you go on to the next one. And anyway, I was sitting in the back of the bus, I think it was sound asleep or something or other. It was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. All of a sudden, the bus stops. I thought, oh, that's strange. Next minute, this chap jumps on and he berates the driver. Oh, got right up him, you know. Then he turns around and he says, all cameras! I said, what do you mean, all cameras? I want all cameras! And I tucked mine under the seat. I said, you're not getting mine, sport. Anyway, I said, what's happened? I said, well, I know. I said, who has taken a photograph of that convoy of tanks that just went past? Me, the fella says. I said, right, give us your camera. Take it out. I said, this one. So we go into the police station. And I sit down. And, oh, they're real ropeable. And I said, show us, it's a digital camera. I said, give us a look. He had 3 photographs of these tanks on a transporter going past. And I said to the fellow, I said, okay, these are photographs. Yeah, you're not allowed. Verboten, you know what. So I said, righto. I said, delete. Dip, 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 dip. Delete. Gone. Gone where? I said, oh no. This is going to take a bit of Luckily, over in the corner was a computer. I walked up to, over here. You see, delete. Bring up something. Push delete. Gone. All right. Anyway, so we got back on the bus. And I abused everybody for taking photographs because I'd already warned them about that. You wouldn't credit it. We got 10, 15 minutes down the road because in between each of the tank transporters, they'd had a security car. And that's what they'd seen, this chap leaning out the window on the side of the bus taking the photographs. So we get down, 10 minutes down the road, all the tank transporters are pulled up. There's no security. They've all stopped to go in and have their cups of tea, etc. We could have walked out and photographed the bloody lot. But anyway, so we got away with it anyway, so that was good. Then, again in Libya, I wanted to take people, when we were in Tobruk, I wanted to take them, we flew into Benghazi. And we're waiting in the airport there for the luggage to come out. And this chap standing alongside me and I'm talking away and he said, "Oh, you're American?" And I said, no, we're Australian. "Oh," he said, what are you doing here?" I said, "We're on a battlefield tour. World War II. He said, no, he said, "Australia, Pacific, not here." I said, "Hang on." I said, "Benghazi was captured by the Australians." "Oh." I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm an oil rig chap. He's from Holland." And I said, "Well, this is what happened." And I gave him a little explanation. "Oh," he said, "oh, that's interesting." He said, "I know all about Arnhem because it was fought in Mum's backyard." But he didn't know anything about Australians that had been in the desert at all. So we get to Brook, and I wanted to take the people out to Post 33, the Italian fortifications that had been built, which were all concrete lined, etc., etc., that the Australians occupied, all had numbers on them. And so Post 33 was where the 2nd 17th Battalion had been, and it was from that post that Corporal Edmondson and Lieutenant Mackay, I think it was Mackay, had sallied forth on the first time the Germans had attacked the Australians at Tobruk. Edmondson, of course, was mortally wounded and came back into Post 33. So he used to take people out to the proximate area they knew where Edmondson and their group. Seven Australians had attacked with rifle and bayonet, had attacked 33 Germans with two mortars, five machine guns, and chased them away, killed quite a few. And so come back and we're in the same spot where Edmondson died, so do all that sort of talk. And then the Libyan bus driver comes up and said, "We must remove ourselves." I said, "Why must we remove ourselves?" The area that was the defence of Tobruk, which is about 25k out from the town, has now been developed, and we were actually walking on someone else's land that we didn't have permission to walk on their land. In other words, if we had asked for permission, we would have had to pay. Right, so that's all it's about. So I said, "All right, we will remove ourselves." So we got away with that without having to cough up any more money. But then there was an airstrip out from Tobruk, out past El Duda. El Duda was where two things happened. The 2nd 13th Battalion did the last attack because they got left behind at Tobruk until Tobruk was relieved. And further out was an airfield the Germans had developed. And all that remains now is a stone pyramid that they used as sort of like a conning tower because it got them up 20 feet, 30 feet up. And of course, 20, 30 feet up, you could see another 15, 20 miles. So I went and asked the people that we'd hired the vehicles off, which was the local policeman. And he said, yeah, I'll take you out there. But he said, "You have to pay." I said, "Oh yeah, how much? So much a vehicle." And he said, "And we have to drive in line like this." I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "Landmines." So actually on the way out there, you could see where a bulldozer or a grader had gone along and turned over the landmines. So when we got out there, I said, no one walks more than 20 feet from this bloody building, this can. So that was all right, so that would happen, and no problems there. With regard to being a battlefield guide, I've been at cemeteries, beautiful cemeteries like a creek. One's in El Alamein, 12,000. One's at the Neck, which is probably twice as big as this room, and there's over 200 Australians buried there. There are only six tombstones with a name on it. Being in Vietnam, and I can tell you there's nothing more exhilarating than being shot at from about 20 feet away for a nil result. A bit of satisfaction in having a reply for a positive result. But the one place I went to was Culloden. I walked the battlefield at Culloden. Now, I don't know. My grandmother was a Nan, born in Scotland, and the Nans were on the right of the Scottish army when they attacked the Duke of Cumberland's army. And I walked along where the Scottish army had walked till I got within about 40, 50 paces from where the British line was. And I don't know whether it's believe in incarnation or a highly imaginative mind, but I couldn't walk any further. I just had an awful cold feeling, and I just stood there for about 20 seconds and I walked away. It's one battlefield I hope I never have to go back to again. Thank you very much.